And we end this science show with another example of that fight against pests killing crops or wild plants. Let's join Tim Entwistle at the Botanic Garden at Mount Annan.
I'm in the plant nursery at the Australian Botanic Garden at Mount Annan, which is part of the Botanic Gardens of Sydney. And it's where I found Brett Summerall, Chief Scientist and Director of Science at the Botanic Gardens. But Brett, you've been here for 37 years, starting as a plant pathologist.
Yes, so I had responsibility for not only doing research in plant diseases, plant biosecurity and the like, but also diagnosing any problems that might pop up in any of the three gardens. So it's a fantastic job to start with.
And the nursery out here at Mount Annan is the largest nursery, I imagine, in the whole of the Botanic Gardens at the moment. And the ones we're surrounded by here are susceptible to a particular pest.
Yeah, so most of the plants surrounding us are species that are critically impacted by a fungal disease called myrtle rust, which came into Australia first detected in about April of 2010. And over the 15 and a bit year period since it's been here, it's spread up and down the coast of Australia, blown across to Broadhowe Island, to New Caledonia, to New Zealand, and is slowly working its way and recently was detected in the top part of WA. So it's moved around and it's had a serious impact on a range of species.
But presumably not on the plants around us here today. So why are you growing all these plants susceptible to that rust?
So most of these species that were surrounded, things like the native guava and scrub turpentine, are almost functionally extinct in the wild. So the impact of the disease has been so severe that the plants either cannot survive, they die, or they cannot reproduce. So they're not able to, the flowers get affected by the disease and seeds are aborted. So we've brought all of this material back to the gardens and a range of other gardens in order to protect it, conserve it, and then try to work out how we can maybe do things that allow us to then reintroduce it back out into the wild.
So are there resistant forms or can you create resistant forms?
So the work we've done so far has shown that particularly in a number of these species that we have around here, that so what we're looking for is to see which individuals are resistant or tolerant of the disease, understand their genetics and using genomic tools, isolate markers and then breed those individuals up and then start to produce seed from those so that we can then use that material to reintroduce it back into the wild, hopefully building up resistance in the natural population.
And the problem here, a rust, is a kind of fungus. This is exactly what you've been working on for 37 and more years.
Yeah. My research interest is in particularly on fungal diseases of plants, and I've really focused on fungal diseases of Australian plants and understanding about their biology, their taxonomy and identifying species, but also looking at ways in which we can fight the problems that they cause.
Now, I know there's one that you've been working on even more closely. There's a genus called Fusarium. You were out early this year warning everyone, and quite as often as you could, in eastern Australia about a beetle, in fact, though, a beetle that was perhaps carrying this disease. I think it's from Asia, but it was coming via Western Australia.
Yes, so over in Perth, people may be aware that the Polyphagus shothole borer, which is a tiny, tiny beetle, about 2 millimetres long, so really difficult to detect, and that's been responsible associated with having something like 5,000 trees having to be removed from particularly the urban communities in Perth, and now they're moving to management rather than looking to eradicate the beetle. And so that's obviously a concern for us in the East Coast for this beetle and the associated fungus that it transmits to be moved to the East Coast. So it's a tricky combination of a beetle and a fungus to work with. The beetle infects the tree, but it also carries this fungus on its chewing implements, if you like, and that spreads up and down the water-carrying tissue of the trees and blocks it so it can't extract water from the soil.
So the beetle itself is not such a big problem. If the beetle was here but not the fungus, it wouldn't be so bad?
It wouldn't be so bad. It obviously has an impact because it's chewing away and boring into the tree, and that's going to have an impact. But it's really the impact then of the fungus moving, blocking the water conducting system in the tree, and that obviously those trees can't survive if they can't extract water from the soil.
Which reminds me a lot of many years ago, and it's still a potential problem, of course, Dutch elm disease, where we have a beetle in Australia that can carry that fungus, but the fungus that I understand is not here, or I'm not sure.
It's a very similar situation where you have this beetle that carries the fungus. Fortunately, at this stage, we don't have the fungus in the country, particularly for those areas like parts of Victoria and the like, where there's lots of elm trees have directly been planted. So at this stage, just the beetle. It's a problem, but it's not a big problem.
So returning back to your polyphagous shothole borer that's in Western Australia, presumably, though, that's going to get here at some point. Once it's here, do you move into a kind of different phase?
Yeah, it then becomes very much about a management phase if it does get here. You know, we know a range of plant species that are likely to be affected by the beetle and the fungal combination, figs and a range of different species, but there's a whole suite of our flora that we don't know what the impact will be. So that's a particular concern. So there's a lot of research happening, particularly in Western Australia, looking at different control options. Our task at this point in time is really about ramping up our opportunities for detection and making sure that if it does get over here, we detect it early and hit it early so that the beetle doesn't have a chance to establish here.
And do you want people to tell you if they find these little distinctive holes in their trees?
Yes, that's certainly the case. There's a biosecurity hotline run by the Department of Primary Industries and Rural Development, and people are well advised to look up the website for that and if they have anything of concern to report it through that hotline.
Now, let me just drop back to Fusarium, which is the fungus that's causing this problem. That's a group I know you've worked on for many years, possibly 37, maybe more.
Probably 42.
And I was interested to see a paper you wrote, I think it's quite a few years ago, with one of your colleagues, John Leslie, from Canberra State University, where I know you spent some time. And in that paper, you were sort of reviewing the situation just quite a few years ago, but you said there could be between 9 and 1,000 species of Fusarium. I was curious to find out which end of that spectrum it's at.
At this stage, it's more towards the 1,000 end of it. 9 was a system that was in place in the 50s, but particularly as we start to work in both natural environments, different types of cropping plants, native plants and the like all around the world, we're finding a large number of species that are in this genus. And all of them have different attributes. All of them have different host plants that they like to attack. So some of them produce a range of toxins. Some are human pathogens. So it's a really important group of fungi that cause huge problems in agriculture, banana apocalypse, as they call it, where we have a particular strain of Fusarium that's causing Panama disease in bananas and spreading around lots of those big growing areas of bananas around the world is a classic example. But we also have a range of toxins that are produced in food stocks and the like. But more and more a problem, particularly in people who are immune suppressed get systemic Fusarium infections, and that can be fatal in those cases.
But the question that people get asked as taxonomists, of which I was once one as well, is the importance of taxonomy and identifying and classifying the species. And as you've said, you found there's perhaps closer to 1,000 than it was originally, only 9 many decades ago. How does that help in managing these diseases and perhaps understanding the problems?
It helps a lot. The accurate detection is really important, particularly in understanding new incursions. So we have a number of Fusarium pathogens that are not present in this country at the moment. So we need to know if, you know, they're coming in. So accurate diagnostics and detection is really important. And it's also about prioritizing where you put the resources into, making sure that you're attacking the real problems and not the smaller problems. And certainly we've found the specific strains that might cause a problem on different cultivars of whether it's wheat or bananas or whatever. It's important to have very accurate diagnostics so that you can prioritize where the money gets spent, where the activities are focused on and how you do it. So that really is. The taxonomy in this particular case is extremely important because it's very difficult otherwise to know how you would prioritize. The investment, the spend, and what you need to do in terms of breeding up a plant for resistance to a particular pathogen, you want to make sure it's the right pathogen.
Quite. And we are in the nursery here, and we're at the Australian Botanic Garden, Mount Annan, and it is a botanic garden. You've got connections and you're a professor of various universities, but you've worked your career in botanic gardens. I just wanted you to reflect back on why you've done that rather than universities and perhaps the benefits of working in a botanic garden.
It's interesting because I came to working at the Botanic Gardens back in 1989. I thought, oh, it'll be a good job for a couple of years. And here I still am in 2025. Botanic gardens are amazing places to do pure research, to do applied research, to have an impact, but also to be able to talk about the work that you do, to be able to engage with the community, with the public, to talk about how you do this, why plants are important. So I'm very passionate about telling the community, talking to the community about the importance of plants, the importance of fungi and those sorts of organisms, getting them to be enthused about it, to recognise that the world is not just green wallpaper. We do suffer from plant blindness. So it's a combination of being able to set up infrastructure that's really important, but do research that has a huge impact on the wonderful native ecosystems that we have here.
And I guess you still have the chance to supervise, which I know you do, lots of students, and to teach at the same time at universities.
Yeah, it's a little bit of best of both worlds. You get the community engagement, you get to work with a fantastic organisations that are doing all sorts of things, whether it's in education, science, or wonderful displays out in the gardens, but also have connections with the universities and to be able to influence the next generation of researchers.
Brett Summerall, Chief Scientist, Director of Science at Botanic Gardens of Sydney, here at Mount Annan Australian Botanic Garden, in a nursery that is pretty impressive, but I guess you always want more space in nurseries and always more facilities.
Absolutely. This, you know, we have some of the most fantastic plant science facilities out here at Mount Annan. We're interested in redeveloping our nursery site to bring it up to standard, particularly for addressing issues like plant conservation, but also the impact of climate change on plant conservation. So, yeah, that's the next big project.
Tim Entwistle, with Chief Scientist at the Royal Botanic Garden, Brett Summerill. Thanks to both.